This audio file is a production of Chiasmos, the University of Chicago's International and Area Studies Multimedia Outreach Source. For related audio and video, or for more information about the project, please visit chiasmos.uchicago.edu or internationalstudies.uchicago.edu.
I'm delighted to welcome you on behalf of our collective project between the University of Chicago Center for International Studies Global Voices Program and the Asia in Chicago program in collaboration with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. The program is co-sponsored by the Korean Consulate in Chicago and the Center for East Asian Studies at the University of Chicago. The program today will be recorded and available on a podcast for future reference on the university's website. And now onto the program. It is my great pleasure to introduce our two distinguished speakers this afternoon, the Ambassador of the Republic of Korea to the United States, Lee Tae-sik, and the United States Ambassador to Korea, Alexander Verschbach. For several years now, the two ambassadors have annually toured the U.S. in an ambassador's dialogue addressing the current security and economic situation in the Korean Peninsula and the state of U.S.-Korea relations, meeting the media and local business representatives in addition to often with state or local political leaders as well. In fact, today has been already a very busy schedule for them, including their visit to the Korean War Memorial at Kennedy Park in Chicago. I think it's the first memorial in the U.S. devoted to the Korean War veterans. Starting with today, in today's schedule in Chicago, the ambassadors and their wives will have tours in various cities in the United States. I am aware that the United States Republic of Korea Ambassador Dialogue Tour Program is first initiated by Ambassador Donald Gregg and Ambassador Hyun Hong-ju in 1992. All of us would agree that the Ambassador's Dialogue Program cannot be more timely and more historically significant than this round, which both relations between the United States and the Republic of Korea and between the United States and the Democratic Republic of Korea have turned around a corner and has just opened a new chapter, which one can cautiously predict that has a happy ending. The six-party talks have set in motion a landmark course leading ultimately to the peaceful coexistence in East Asia. The FTA between the South Korea and the United States reached a consensus. And we just heard that Governor Bill Richardson and a delegation of U.S. envoys crossed the DMZ with the remains of six American servicemen from the Korean War. Now I'm going to introduce two ambassadors. Ambassador Lee Tae-sik and Ambassador Alexander Verschbach have a number of things in common. To begin with, the timing of their ambassadorial duties respectively regarding the United States and the Republic of Korea. Just as Ambassador Lee became the South Korean ambassador to the United States in late 2005, so did Ambassador Verschbach become the ambassador to the Republic of Korea. Second, both of them were born in a very historical city in their own country. Ambassador Lee was born in the city of Gyeongju, the city of the capital city of Silla, the country that unified three kingdoms and existed from the until the 10th century. And Ambassador Verschbach was born, in turn, was born in Boston, Massachusetts. And third, both ambassadors' wives often attract media attention. Mrs. Lee Sungnam is extremely envied by women in and outside of Korea ever since her son, a Korea diplomat just like her husband, accompanied President Nomuyan during his visit to England in December 2005 as official interpreter for him. What appeared to be a working of magic was that during the meetings between President No and Queen Elizabeth and also Prime Minister Blair, the then Korean ambassador to the United Kingdom happened to be her husband. And during the President Roh's meeting with President George W. Bush during the APAC conference last year, President interpreter was again her son, and the Korean ambassador to the United States, again, her husband. Speaking of Mrs. Lisa Virchow, one has to note that her husband also modeled for her in her exhibition because she's an artist. She's a very renowned contemporary jewel designer and also metal craft artist. Her exhibitions had been in both Russia and Korea numerously. I suppose that while both ambassadors and wives must have been juggled with the demands of foreign affairs and also domestic affairs, they all seem to have been fallen to one area in parenting, raising girls. They only have sons. But these are all the things that they have in common. But perhaps more relevant to today's talks, both ambassadors have made important efforts in their area of public service that have prepared them to be the best ambassadors, respectively, for the two countries now, a time that is one of the most important historical moments in U.S.-Korea diplomatic history. I want to introduce Ambassador Lee first. Ambassador Lee Tae-sik is a Korea diplomat whose service for his country covers four decades and four continents. Born on October 26, 1945, Ambassador Lee is one of those we call Haebangdongi, the child who was born in the year of liberation from Japan. And he graduated from the Department of International Relations at Seoul National University and also from the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Ambassador Lee has served in various locations around the globe, to name a few: Liberia, the Philippines, Austria, Yugoslavia, and the European Union. He also has held several senior-level positions throughout the Korean government, including Director General of the International Trade Bureau at Ministry of Foreign Affairs, MOFA, and the Deputy Executive Director of Korean Peninsula Economy Development Organization, KEDO, and Assistant Secretary to the Korean President. His first ambassadorial posting was an ambassador to Israel, where he served until February 2002, when he was called back to serve as the Deputy Minister for Foreign Affairs. In his capacity as the Deputy Foreign Minister, he led Korean delegations in various security negotiations and consultations, particularly addressing North Korea's nuclear issues. In June 2003, he became the Korean ambassador to the United Kingdom, and in January 2005, he was posted back to Seoul as Vice Minister of Foreign Affairs and Trade. And Ambassador Lee presented his credentials as Korean ambassador to the United States President Bush in November 2005. I'm moving to Ambassador Virchow. Ambassador Virchow was sworn in as ambassador to the Republic of Korea on October 14, 2005, and took up his duties right after that. A Korean member of the Foreign Service with the rank of Korean minister, he has extensive experience in East-West relations, as well as non-proliferation and European security affairs. From July 2001 to July 2005, Ambassador Virchow served as the United States Ambassador to the Russian Federation. During this tenure, the ambassador worked to promote U.S.-Russian cooperation in the areas of counterterrorism and counterproliferation, and to expand the agenda to encompass new challenges such as HIV/AIDS issues. He received the American Bar Association's 204 Ambassadors Award for his efforts for the causes of democracy, human rights, and the rule of law in Russia. From January 1998 until July 2001, Ambassador Virchow served as the U.S. Ambassador to NATO. As U.S. Permanent Representative on the North Atlantic Council, Ambassador Virchow was involved in transforming NATO to meet post-Cold War challenges in various ways, In June 2001, Secretary of State Colin Powell awarded him the State Department's Distinguished Service Award for his work at NATO. From 1994 till to 1997, Ambassador Varshava served as special assistant to the President and Senior Director for European Affairs at the National Security Council. And in October 1997, former Secretary of Defense William Cohen presented him with the first annual Joseph Kutzel Award for his contributions to the cause of peace. Ambassador Varshava is a long-term student of Russian affairs and also international relations. He's received a BA in Russian and Eastern European Studies from Yale and a master's degree in international relations and certificate of Russian Institute from Columbia University. He has held a series of assignments since joining the Foreign Service in 1977, including postings to the U.S. embassies in Moscow and London, advisor to the U.S. delegation to the strategic arms reductions talks in Geneva, and deputy U.S. permanent representative of NATO. He was a director of the State Department's Office of Soviet Union Affairs during the last years of Soviet Union. In 1990, he was awarded the Anatoly Sharansky Freedom Award by the Union of Councils of Soviet Jews for his work in advancing the cause of Jewish emigration from the USSR. Now, I welcome the two ambassadors to our campus, and also very pleased to announce that now we have a new consul general in Chicago, Sun Sung Hwan. I don't know where he is. Yes, he is there. As became customary, I remind you to turn off all electronic device that might provoke any unpleasant faces, looks if they were to bring out some signs. Without further ado, please join me in welcoming Ambassadors Lee Tae-shik and Ambassador Varshava.
Thank you for your kind introduction, Ms. Choi Kyung-hee. I'm very pleased to be here this evening to talk about our two countries' relationship. Ms. Choi Kyung-hee touched upon the commonality between Ambassador Varshava and myself. One thing we have in common is that we are all professional diplomats. His diplomatic lifespan and mine almost coincidental. And sooner or later, we will have to retire from this office. But until that very last moment, what we have in common again is to work for each other's national interest. That's for sure. But another thing here, again, is that we are not espousing our own country's interest. When we talk about U.S.-Korea relationship, what we do is we stress the importance of U.S.-Korea relationship or Korea-U.S. relationship. That's the theme that we are advocating. That's the theme that we are defending. That's the theme that we are promoting. Good evening. First of all, I want to thank our gracious host at the University of Chicago and the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. As was noted, Ambassador Varshava and I are pleased to be here to kick off our second annual cross-country tour to discuss the dynamic Korea-U.S. partnership. We hope this forum will provide some new insight into what I like to describe as one of the most successful alliances in history. This is not an overstatement if you look at the daunting array of challenges our relationship has faced over the past 50 years. I think you will find that it is a remarkable, even unparalleled, success story. From repelling communism on the Korean Peninsula to constructing a successful industrial economy, from the struggle to secure democracy to the effort to become a contributing member of the world community. I'm very happy that we have our Korean War veterans here this evening. For those who are here, our compliments always with you, and had it not been for your effort and sacrifice, Korea, as we know, would not have been in existence. Always, we extend our most heartfelt gratitude and thankfulness. None of these achievements was a given. In fact, most were considered long shots, but with the unique bond of understanding and commitment our two countries share, we overcame the odds. Our Korea-U.S. alliance saw us through. Continuing this track record of success, I am pleased to note that this past year produced two more significant achievements. The first concerns the United Nations. For Korea, the UN has always meant more than just another global institution. After all, it was under the auspices of the UN that our country fought off communism and being saved. So it is somewhat of a paradox that it took 40 years more and that the Cold War's demise before we were actually admitted as a former member of that particular organization. And this was in 1991. Last year, however, just 15 years later, a South Korean was elected to the top office of United Nations Secretary General. So when our former Foreign Minister Ban Ki-moon took the helm of this organization on January the 1st this year, it was definitely a feeling for Korea of coming full circle. From a full recipient country to a position where we are now able to provide leadership to the organization. The other milestone of this past year is the successful negotiation of a Korea-U.S. free trade agreement. This free trade agreement is literally a big deal, marrying the world's largest and 10th largest economies into the biggest bilateral free trade pact in the world. Of course, there were times during the marathon negotiations when the outcome was not clear, especially as the talks passed not one, but two so-called final deadlines, as Ambassador Buschbaum can also attest. But in the end, with vision, flexibility, and leadership from the highest levels of our two governments, our negotiators prevailed. The result is a historic, high-quality, and forward-looking agreement. This FTA is a triumph on several levels for the Korean and U.S. economies. For consumers who are the ultimate beneficiaries in this, and for the overall future of our alliance. First, the FTA will propel our country's economic relationship to the next level. According to the U.S. International Trade Commission, the FTA would expand American exports to Korea by as much as $19 billion per year, while South Korean exports could realize a $10 billion boost. For Korea, President Nomu-hyun has risked alienating many of his core supporters in a bold effort to advance Korea's global competitiveness. His position is that with improved access to the world's largest and most sophisticated market, the FTA with the United States will serve as a springboard for South Korea to become an advanced economy. For the U.S., President Bush summed it up well when he noted that this FTA will generate export opportunities for U.S. farmers, ranchers, manufacturers and service suppliers, and promote economic growth and the creation of better-paying jobs in the United States. For example, under the agreement, $1.9 billion worth of U.S. farm exports to Korea will become duty-free immediately. In addition, with regard to U.S. beef, the largest U.S. agricultural export product to Korea at $9 billion in 2003. Sorry, $0.9 billion. The duties will be eliminated completely over the years. The agreement will also open up the Korean auto market to U.S. cars, not only by immediately removing the 8% duties, but also by simplifying its tax structure and reducing existing tax rates. At the same time, the FTA will expand market access and investment opportunities in many service sectors, including telecommunications, finance, audiovisual, and business services. Overall, the FTA will provide new access to Korea's prosperous market of 48 million people. Furthermore, increased access to the Korean market can provide American companies an important new foothold in the dynamic Asian region, where the U.S. has been losing market share to European, Japanese, and Chinese competitors. The second big winner in the FTA is consumers, who will benefit from greater choices and more affordable prices, a point that sometimes gets lost in the arcane policy debate. Within the first 3 years, the FTA would remove tariffs on nearly 94% of the product categories we trade, and after 10 years, virtually all remaining tariffs will be eliminated. So from automobiles and pork to digital televisions and textiles, citizens in both countries will be better off. Finally, besides benefiting both business and consumers, the FTA provides a boon to our overall bilateral relationship as our enhanced economic alliance powerfully reinforces our traditional security-based alliance. You could think of the FTA as adding a steady gust of wind in our alliance sails. In fact, the Korea-U.S. FTA is our most significant agreement since the 1953 Mutual Defense Treaty that established the Korea-U.S. alliance. We expect it will take some work over the coming months for our respective legislatures to ratify an agreement of this scope, so we would certainly welcome your support in this effort. On the political front, Korea and the U.S. have started to have strategic dialogues on global affairs. Our two foreign ministers sit down regularly with U.S. Secretary of State for strategic bilateral discussions on a range of bilateral, regional, and international issues. In this context, our two nations are working together on such bilateral global concerns as terrorism, WMD proliferation, human rights, poverty, and the environment. On the security front, we are looking to the future as well. Having recently addressed such key alliance issues as the relocation and realignment of U.S. forces in Korea, strategic flexibility, wartime operational control, and burden sharing in the defense of Korean Peninsula. The most daunting and critical challenges we face then is the North Korean nuclear issue. It is vital that we resolve this problem or we risk living under nuclear fear. And the ramifications of a nuclear North Korea extend even beyond the Korean Peninsula to Northeast Asia and elsewhere, with the danger of nuclear proliferation and the possibility of a regional nuclear arms race. After more than a decade of negotiations on this subject, we know that engaging North Korea is not only strategically important, but extremely complicated and complex. We also know that this issue can be fully resolved only when North Korea becomes a responsible member of the international community. Therefore, this challenge requires a comprehensive approach. The North Korean nuclear issue cannot be resolved solely as a security problem. We need a multifaceted approach, which involves a range of both political and economic efforts. These include efforts to normalize relations with North Korea, establish a permanent peace regime on the Korean Peninsula, and build a regional security mechanism while promoting economic integration. The roadmap we are using is the September 19, 2005 joint statement, which was agreed by all six parties and contains all the basic principles for resolution of the North Korean nuclear issue. To this end, this past February, the six-party talks in Beijing produced an important step-by-step plan to implement this comprehensive agreement. So in other words, in this phase, we are moving from talk to action. According to this February 13th document, North Korea consented to shut down and seal for the ultimate purpose of abandonment its nuclear facilities. It also agreed to invite back IAEA inspectors and to undertake discussions on a list of all its nuclear programs. The other five parties, namely South Korea, the US, China, Russia, and Japan, are taking corresponding measures, including the provision of economic, energy, and humanitarian assistance, as well as talks concerning the normalization of relations with the North. The five working groups that were formed to address specific aspects of the agreement got off to a good start. But the talks hit the snag due to some technical difficulties in a banking matter that North Korea and the U.S. were working to resolve. Although it sounded rather simple, completing this international transaction turned out to be quite a bit more difficult than just going to an ATM machine. Fortunately, we are now getting back on track as we proceed toward the ultimate objective of attaining permanent peace on the Korean Peninsula. People sometimes still ask whether North Korea is serious about abandoning its nuclear program, or whether they can be trusted. Well, unlike deaths and the currently looming deadline for taxes, nothing is certain. However, the commitments North Korea has made on September 19, 2005 and February 13 this year are positive indications that North Korea is willing to go down the right path, the path that will lead to peace on the Korean Peninsula and the region, and eventually to becoming a responsible member of community of nations. Looking ahead, Korea and the U.S. should continue to gather our wisdom and strengthen our coordination with confidence. This way, our enhanced Korea-U.S. alliance, along with improved inter-Korean relations, can work in tandem like two wheels on a cart. Considering our track record over the past 50 years, I believe we are up to meeting any challenge that may come our way. And I'm pleased to say that our two countries' approach to North Korean nuclear issue or North Korean issue as a whole is quite in sync with each other. So we are not apart from each other. We are taking the same approach with respect to North Korean issue. In sum, our half-century alliance has overcome every major obstacle we have faced. And with our ongoing efforts to modernize our partnership, I could expect the future to be no different. What is the secret to our success? In regards to our history, culture, and traditions, our countries are very different. Still, in spite of these obvious differences in the areas that matter most, such as our deep-seated belief in equality, opportunity, self-governance, free speech, and the other essential individual rights we think alike. For both Americans and Koreans, these beliefs are at our core. As well, I think Korea can also identify with America's innate optimism. According to a major Korean opinion poll, more than 80% of respondents said the United States is the country of greatest help to Korea. Now, with all this said, I don't mean to suggest that our relationship is always fair skies and following winds. We encounter our share of turbulent waters. But as our two countries are usually headed toward the same goals, we tend to be able to navigate a course that works to our mutual satisfaction. Some might view our success as an alliance of overachievers, but that is just the way we operate. And the rest, as they say, is our history and our combined history. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Che, for your introduction earlier, and thanks to Ambassador Lee Tae-shik for his interesting comments. It's a great pleasure for me to be kicking off our second joint roadshow. I think we really are soulmates, to pardon the pun, because our relationship really does reflect a lot of shared interests and shared values, and that's what I'd like to talk to you about today. If, like me, you've had the opportunity to travel to Korea, or if you visit Ambassador Lee's embassy website, you're probably familiar with the slogan, Dynamic Korea. And I find it to be a very accurate description of what it feels like to be on the streets of Seoul, where the air seems to be laden with energy, enthusiasm, even effervescence. You can feel the real can-do attitude of the people there. I've been in countries that are rising, countries that have reached a plateau, and countries in decline. And these days, we hear a great deal about the rise of China, and deservedly so. But if, like me, you have recently spent any amount of time in Seoul, you know that the Republic of Korea is definitely on the rise, and that a truly exceptional transformation within that country is continuing to unfold. So I feel very fortunate to be serving in Korea during such a dynamic part of its history. It's exciting to drive through Seoul at night. You have centuries-old gates and palace walls that are lit gracefully from below, while billboard-sized flat TV screens blaze advertisements from the buildings above. Stores, shops, and karaoke rooms compete for attention with the brilliance of their neon lights. Seoul is really a bustling city by day, but at night you can see and feel the vibrancy of modern Korea, even amid the ancient roots of Korean society. In my 18 months as a U.S. ambassador, I realized that it's not just Korea that is dynamic. The United States' relationship with Korea is also changing and growing as well. With new energy and enthusiasm, it's transforming into a more mature, healthy, and balanced partnership. One of the greatest examples of the dynamism in our bilateral relationship is the recently concluded Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, or as we call it, the CORUS FTA. Until a few years ago, the United States and South Korea had a rather contentious trade relationship, and our economic dialogue consisted mostly of the United States pressuring Korea to lift trade barriers. The contrast with 2007 couldn't be starker. The FTA that we just concluded is a comprehensive one. It's an agreement negotiated voluntarily by both sides that will make the United States and the Republic of Korea each other's privileged economic partner across the Pacific. Our Congress and the Korean National Assembly have yet to ratify this important trade accord, but it's really hard to overstate the magnitude of change that this agreement represents. You may have heard that this is the largest FTA that Korea has ever negotiated, and it's the largest FTA the United States has negotiated since NAFTA in the early 90s. As Ambassador Lee mentioned, tariffs on virtually all manufactured goods and agricultural products that are traded between our two countries will be eliminated, with 94% of both sides' industrial tariffs disappearing within the first 3 years after the FTA goes into effect. In addition, the FTA has chapters that address other non-tariff barriers, such as intellectual property protection, barriers to investment, service sector barriers, and technical barriers to trade or standards. Now, of course, there are some areas where each side might have liked to get a little bit more from the FTA talks, but a fundamental tenet of any negotiation is that neither side gets 100% of what it wants. So we couldn't and we shouldn't let the perfect be the enemy of what in this case is the very, very good. First and foremost, the FTA will boost trade and investment in both directions. Although the two sides are starting from different baseline levels of trade, both will see a significant boost in exports as the benefits of tariff elimination and removal of non-tariff barriers begin to come through. Second, by implementing measures that will create a more hospitable environment for foreign investment, Korea should be able to attract more U.S. investors, thereby better positioning itself as a Northeast Asian hub. Finally, by opening up our two economies to greater competition, both countries will see efficiency gains leading to more economic growth and job creation. And this is where the benefits will actually be somewhat greater on the Korean side, since Korea will be eliminating more inefficiencies in its economy, particularly in its highly protected agricultural and service sectors. Greater efficiency means that both countries will enhance their competitiveness, and this is very important as we both deal with the rise of new economic powers like China and India. Now, it's also important to note that the impact of this FTA will go far beyond bilateral commercial benefits. It's also a powerful symbol of a U.S.-Korea partnership, augmenting our longstanding bilateral security alliance and the robust ties between the Korean and American people. It will be a new dynamic, reflecting both the growing sophistication of our bilateral relationship and the Republic of Korea's increasingly positive global role in the world. So as Korea looks for credible international partners, the United States is the natural choice, for we're a country that brings no regional territorial issues or uncertain motivations to the table. The many Korean friends of America may not make it onto CNN the way that the protesters sometimes do, but the successful completion of the FTA talks and the strong support that they've generated in Korea clearly demonstrate that the protesters do not speak for the majority of the Korean people, who are confident of their ability to compete in the world market and who value their partnership with the United States. Now, in order for our two countries to thrive economically, we do have to continue to maintain peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula and in the region. Security has always been, and it remains, the cornerstone of the US-ROK alliance, but extensive changes in South Korea's society, economy, and military forces are prompting dynamic changes in our security alliance as well. What has not changed is our strong commitment to our ally as embodied in the US-ROK Mutual Defense Treaty signed 54 years ago. What is changing is that in sharp contrast to South Korea's need for US military assistance in the 1950s, today's highly capable ROK military is taking greater responsibility for Korea's own defense, and it's even helping the citizens of Iraq and Afghanistan to rebuild their war-torn lives. A South Korean is now Secretary General of the United Nations, and the ROK is even sending peacekeepers to Lebanon. As a result of the impressive improvements in the abilities of the South Korean military and the global transformation of our own U.S. armed forces, Seoul and Washington have recently reached an agreement to transfer wartime operational control, or OPCON as it's known, from the current U.S.-led Combined Forces Command to the Korean military in April 2012. We transferred peacetime OPCON back in the 90s, and as then, this is the next step in the continuing evolution of the strong and trusted alliance that exists between our two countries. Other healthy and dynamic changes in the alliance include the relocation of U.S. forces away from prime real estate in the heart of Seoul to a new and improved hub to the south in the town of Pyeongtaek. From there, we'll be able to carry out our continuing alliance responsibilities for as long as the security partnership between us endures. And I think that will be for a very long time. Now, transfer of wartime operational control and the FTA show the dynamic pace at which Korean society is moving. But what I find especially fascinating are Korea's young people, who are at the leading edge of that change. You see them everywhere, listening to their MP3 players and talking, watching movies, taking pictures, video conferencing, and even surfing the net on the latest cell phones. The reach of mobile phone technology in today's Korea is a preview of what we may see here in the States a few years from now. My two sons love to come to Korea because they say you can see the future there. Many young Koreans are active in civil society. Unlike their parents and grandparents, today's Korean youth have grown up in a country marked by democracy and relative affluence. Young Koreans are not only the most wired group in the world, they're also informed and outspoken about their views, exerting significant influence on both political and social discourse in Korea today. They're also proud, and rightly so, of their country, its accomplishments, and the global appeal of Korean culture. The so-called Korean wave of movies, TV soap operas, and music stars has already swept across Asia with great success, and it's even now reached the shores of the United States. The Korean film The Host was recently shown in theaters across America, getting hit reviews on this side of the Pacific, as well as back in Korea. And while my own tastes run more towards classic rock and roll and jazz, it's impossible to argue with the success that Korean pop superstars like Rain have achieved. Rain is one of the first true Asian crossover artists on the American music scene, and it's hard to move up from being Time Magazine's second most influential artist of the year for 2006. In today's dynamic Korea, many cultural and societal paradigms are also shifting, opening up new possibilities for Korean women. Last year, Korea named its first female prime minister. And this year, one of the serious contenders for the presidential election in December is a woman. And later in the year, one or two more female candidates may enter the race. Who knows? And now there are more women in the workforce, and many young Korean women feel that having children and even marriage are optional. There are repercussions, of course. South Korea now has the lowest birth rate among OECD countries, and Korean men are finding it harder and harder to get hitched. interestingly, intercultural marriages in Korea now account for 35 to 40% of all new marriages in the rural regions. As South Koreans become more intricately linked to the world outside, they're thinking of themselves as global citizens, and they feel responsible for helping those around them. NGOs tell us that Koreans are quick to donate both money and manpower for global relief efforts like the Pakistan earthquake and the Asian tsunami. And I witnessed this firsthand when I arrived in Seoul soon after Hurricane Katrina. Many individual Koreans mailed in money. Some individuals gave as much as $100,000. And it was really a moving experience that provided me with a much better understanding of Korean generosity and the affinity that most Koreans feel toward America. Now, over the years, South Korea's relationship with and its views about North Korea have evolved considerably. Many younger South Koreans view the North not so much as an enemy, but as a country of fellow Koreans with the same culture and history, but who are down on their luck and in need of economic and humanitarian assistance. Some Koreans remain very concerned about the threat to security and stability posed by the North, but my observation is that the threat perception is lower than it used to be. Across the spectrum, however, South Koreans stand with the rest of the international community in seeking a denuclearized North Korea. And so it's towards this end that South Korea has joined with the United States and the other six-party countries in delivering a firm response to North Korea's provocative actions of last year, their missile launches in July and the nuclear test that they conducted in October. The Koreans have worked closely with us in laying the basis for the resumption of the six-party talks late last year and in sending a clear message to the North that it must live up to its obligations to denuclearize. So as Ambassador Lee mentioned, on February 13th, the parties did agree upon a series of concrete initial actions to be carried out over a 60-day period that would start the process of implementing the breakthrough agreement that was reached 2 years ago, the joint statement of September 2005. In that agreement, the North Koreans agreed to get rid of all their nuclear weapons and existing nuclear programs. In return, the other parties agreed to provide economic and energy assistance, to normalize political relations, to negotiate a permanent peace regime to replace the, quote, temporary armistice that ended the Korean War 54 years ago, and to work toward peace and security in the wider Northeast Asia region. There have indeed been some technical issues that have complicated the implementation of the February 13th agreement, but we and our partners are determined to keep up the momentum. And in particular, we expect the North Koreans to fulfill their commitment to shut down and seal the nuclear reactor and reprocessing facility at Yongbyon, which has produced plutonium for several nuclear weapons, and to do so with monitoring and verification by the International Atomic Energy Agency. Only then will the North receive the energy aid, 50,000 tons of heavy fuel oil, that was promised under the February 13th agreement. Now, there have been some important steps already despite these technical problems we've had over the banking matter. The head of the IAEA, Mohammed El-Baradei, visited North Korea last month to discuss the concrete steps needed to verify the shutdown of the Yongbyon facility. The five working groups established under the February 13th agreement have all met. These groups are taking up the details of denuclearization, the question of how to improve North Korea's energy supply and its economic conditions, as well as longer-term issues, including normalization of North Korea's relations with the United States and Japan, and a Northeast Asia regional security mechanism. So there still is much work to be done before the initial actions are complete, and even more work ahead in the next phase of the process, the disablement of all DPRK nuclear facilities, and a complete declaration by the North of all of its nuclear programs. As our Chief Negotiator, Assistant Secretary Hill, has said, it's our goal to accomplish all of these steps, the ones envisaged in Phase 2, before the end of this year. And as the February 13th agreement states, the other parties will provide economic and energy aid equivalent to another 950,000 tons of heavy fuel oil in connection with the DPRK's disablement of its nuclear facilities and the issuance of a complete declaration. And we're also prepared to take steps toward improving our bilateral relations. But all these steps are clearly linked to performance by the North Koreans in fulfilling their obligations. Now, I should stress that the steps that I've just described under the February 13th agreement and in Phase 2 are only a way station toward the ultimate goal, which is the complete dismantlement of North Korea's nuclear weapons and its existing nuclear programs as set forth in the 2005 joint statement. And it's only with complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization that we can agree to the full normalization of relations with the DPRK and the conclusion of a permanent peace regime on the Korean Peninsula. These are ambitious goals, but we believe that they can be achieved during 2008 if the North Koreans have the political will to do so. We stand ready to do our part if they do. Before I conclude, let me just mention one other important issue that's on our agenda. It's the issue of providing visa-free travel for Koreans who wish to visit the United States. The desire of South Koreans to experience the world, and particularly the United States, through travel and study continues to grow. Last year, our embassy in Seoul processed more than 450,000 visas. the largest number of any of our embassies in the world. And we could break the 500,000 mark this year. For the last 2 years, the number of young people from Korea who study in the United States has exceeded those from any other country, over 100,000 in 2006. Millions of Koreans have visited the United States, and a visa waiver for Korea would make those numbers even more dynamic. And I would certainly like to lose our record-breaking status as the largest visa-issuing post in the world. So to facilitate not only more travelers, but safer and more secure travel, I sincerely hope we can make real progress toward full Korean participation in the visa waiver program. There's currently legislation pending in the Congress that would allow for that, and we're watching the situation very closely. The House and the Senate have both passed bills that now must be reconciled by a conference committee. We don't yet know what the committee will decide, but I'm hopeful and fully supportive of Korea's efforts to join the visa waiver program. So let me wrap up by just saying that there is no doubt that times are changing and that South Korea is experiencing not only a very dynamic present, but a very dynamic future. As the United States and Korea cooperate to achieve common goals, such as the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, increased bilateral trade and investment, and safer and easier travel, our alliance will grow stronger, healthier, and more resilient than ever before. I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to offer my perspective after a year and a half as ambassador to the ROK. I look very much forward to hearing your views and to answering any questions that you might have. Thank you very much.
I would like to ask you to identify yourself by stating your name and affiliation before asking questions. Yes, gentlemen there.
China's role in the context of Northeast Asia's peace and security is extremely important. And yet, that is not good enough. The reason is very simple. If we want to achieve something and that will ensure peace and stability in Korea, we will have to do something about U.S.-North Korean relationship. And that is the normalization. And that's what we are doing at the moment in the context of six-party talk. In the context of these six-party talks, also China's role has been very important and helpful. And yet, it is essential, and yet, it is not everything. Again, China can push North Korea to do something, to be more flexible in the position, in its position, and to be more cooperative in the negotiation. And yet, as we perhaps know, China's relationship with North Korea is not what it used to be, by which I mean they have just restructured their relationship on the basis of normal sort of relationship between any two normal countries. And traditionally, their relationship was somewhat uneven one. And therefore, in this uneven alliance partnership, one party was predominant, and the other party was rather dependent. Although North Korea has declared that its foreign policy is rather independent approach. And yet, there was a certain traditional ties in which China's influence was very strong, but this is not the same as it used to be, and it's also changing. So a new relationship between China and North Korea is also emerging, and therefore what we have to do to ensure the peace and stability in Northeast Asia is to make North Korea change in our constant engagement with the country and the leadership. Who can do that the most, and who can be most effective? That's the United States. Eventually, what North Korea has in mind is to normalize its relationship with North Korea and to establish some kind of peaceful relationship with Washington. So, and this ultimate goal for North Korea as well as regional countries, China can do something, South Korea can do something, US can do something, and others as well. And yet, China's role is important, essential, but United States determination and role, I believe, is much more important.
I would agree with most of what Ambassador Lee has just said. China has played a very helpful role over the past couple of years, both in the brokering of the September 2005 joint statement and in getting the talks back on track after the long period when the North Koreans were boycotting the talks. I think the North Koreans, who are still very heavily dependent on China for their economic survival, both in terms of food and energy assistance, I think the North Koreans were shocked when the Chinese reacted as negatively as they did to the missile tests and the nuclear test. I don't think North Korea expected China to support a resolution in the UN Security Council under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which makes it legally binding and which imposed sanctions on North Korea. And I think China's harsh reaction helped convince the North Koreans that they were facing a very dangerous period of isolation and they needed to come back to the talks. But that being said, China's role, as the ambassador said, is not unlimited. They're not able to solve this on their own. And I think the virtue of the six-party process is that it brings all the concerned players together, each of them with different sources of leverage and different carrots and different sticks that they can apply. And so we need everyone to contribute. Russia can do a lot more than they've been doing in the six-party process. Japan has decisive influence to play. Unfortunately, their involvement is stymied by the impasse over the abductions issue. But I think that if we work together and maintain a united front and encourage China to play a continually constructive role, we just might be able to solve this problem. I would add one observation about China. They clearly are torn between two different objectives. On the one hand, they want to get rid of North Korea's nuclear weapons for fear of instability on their border and also for fear that a continued possession of nuclear weapons by the North could stimulate other countries in the region, especially Japan, to contemplate going nuclear as well. But against that, they are afraid of instability in North Korea, or even the collapse of the regime and the millions of refugees that might flow into China in that scenario. So they're trying to have a balancing act, keep stability in the North, but get rid of the nukes. And at some point, they may have to face a strategic choice. And we hope that they choose denuclearization as being more important than the survival of Kim Jong-il's regime.
Any other questions?
Actually, the latest opinion polls show improving support for the relationship with the United States and for the U.S. ROK military alliance. And at least the initial impact of the completion of FTA talks has been a further upturn in the polls. The agreement itself, in some polls, is getting support as high as 60% to 65%. So I'm a little bit more optimistic about the trends. I think this tilt in perceptions towards China was more significant 2-3 years ago, but I think problems in Korea's relations with China, some historical disputes over territory, have contributed to a cooling of people's ardor and a resurgence of support for the U.S. So we can't take any of this for granted. Moods can swing. But I'm a little bit more encouraged.
Yes, I agree with the observation made by Ambassador Birchbaum. Yes, in Korea these days, the perception with respect to the United States has been changing very significantly in favor. And that has been rather remarkable. perhaps you would come up with different popular fall outcome. And yet recently, there was quite an important popular poll. According to this outcome, when the respondent was asked about which country is the most important in the preservation of security of South Korea, the U.S. with 83 percentage point of respondents. And also another question, this is also very interesting and important. Which country can contribute the most for the maintenance of peace and stability in Korean Peninsula? Interestingly, not China, the United States with 82 percentage points. So this is rather remarkable shift in our country's public perception with respect to United States and China. Although we have to say that China has become number one trading partner for South Korea. We have established our diplomatic ties back in 1992. In 15 years' time, China has become number one trading partner for Korea, more than our trade with Japan, more than with the United States. That is true. So perhaps many people or some people would say that based on this remarkable economic interaction and based on traditional sort of security concerns between the two countries, relationship between Korea and China would be much more predominant in Northeast Asian context. Perhaps there is a certain credence to this observation, and yet for South Korea to ensure its own security and stability for now and the future, the relationship with the United States is extremely important. We have this military or political alliance. We have this strong military partnership that has preserved our country's freedom and democracy. When we have this new free trade agreement with the United States, that will ensure our two countries' relationship in economic dimension, but more importantly, you could remember the famous saying that all the road comes to Rome, but after the collapse of Cold War in current world, all the road come to the economics. Economics is the number one statecraft effort. And so here, if we are to survive again, we need to do something more in economics. And that is why we are forging this relationship. When we forged this new or additionally important economic ties with the United States, that will ensure not only Korea's economic advancement, but also its own political and security concern as well. Here again, Northeast Asia has been the area where big power rivalry has been predominant in the past. And Korea has become always the victim of the rivalries between big powers. We don't want to be the victim of big power rivalries anymore. And in that sense, U.S. could become some kind of stabilizing force in the Korean Peninsula as well as in Northeast Asian context. U.S. troops eventually will not remain there as a part of alliance forces, but more importantly, when we establish peaceful regime in Korean context, then U.S. will become much more important stabilizing force. In that sense, yes, this FTA will contribute to the further stabilization or stabilizing of our Korean Peninsula, and it will be very much conducive to the maintenance of peace and security. China's role, very important. And our relationship with China economically, politically, diplomatically, very important. But we don't have any military sort of relationship with China. Thank you.
Okay.
My perception is that it hasn't probably had all that much direct impact on the ups and downs of the negotiations. I think that one hears a lot of complaints about our theater missile defense cooperation with Japan and North Korean propaganda, but how much of a factor this is in their threat perception, I don't know. Let's remember, these are defensive programs. They do not carry even explosive warheads. They're using various high-tech kinetic approaches to shooting down missiles that might be falling upon Japan. So we think it's a perfectly legitimate field for U.S.-Japanese defense cooperation, especially when the missiles that were tested last July, the ones that were successfully tested, are the ones that can reach Japan and South Korea. So I think it's a necessary aspect of our efforts to deter the North and to convince them that it's much better for them to seek a negotiated solution, to come out of their isolation and establish normal relations with the rest of the world. And the threat that has called forth these theater missile defense programs will hopefully no longer exist. So, but in terms of actual conduct of the talks, we don't really hear much about it beyond North Korean propaganda. The transfer of operational control, as we've decided to do it in the year 2012, is not going to mean the end of our alliance. It's just an evolution of the alliance, and it doesn't have anything to do with the continued presence of U.S. forces on the Korean Peninsula. We are prepared to keep forces there as long as we are welcome by the people and the government of the Republic of Korea. So the command arrangements for our forces will change. We'll have to write new operational plans, and we have to make sure that we've fully trained and exercised the new system before we make the transfer. But we believe that we can continue to maintain stability, to deter the North under the future arrangements, just as we have done so today. Now, through the six-party talks, if we're successful, we can certainly lower the threat by eliminating North Korea's nuclear weapons. And hopefully the broader framework that is set forth in the September 2005 joint statement can also be implemented, and that would, we hope, lead to a permanent peace regime to replace the armistice, and with it perhaps measures to lower the level of military confrontation between the North and the South. A peace treaty is not simply a legal ending to the state of war, but hopefully will involve other measures that establish trust and confidence between North and South. So in that context, we might see some changes in force deployments on the part of both the ROK and the U.S. But I would say that no matter what, we will do everything to maintain deterrence, to deter North Korean aggression, and at the same time, to provide a factor for peace and stability in the broader Northeast Asian region. I think that our alliance will remain important even if we completely succeed in the six-party talks because of broader security conditions in the region. You mentioned some of them, China, Japan. In fact, I think we have two key pillars in the region, the U.S.-Korean alliance and the U.S.-Japanese alliance, and we would like to maintain those strong and healthy relationships for the indefinite future.
Six-party talks are currently focusing our attention on the resolution of North Korea's nuclear problem because that is most burning and pressing issue. But after this nuclear issue being resolved, we will have to go beyond that, and that is to ensure the permanent peace and security in Korean Peninsula on the one hand, and Northeast Asia as a whole. now. In this context, what six-party talks can contribute or not contribute, what kind of role it can play. This is why when the six-party countries have agreed on this joint statement of September 19, 2005, there you have quite a comprehensive component which will ensure the peace and stability in Northeast Asia as a whole after the resolution of North Korea's nuclear problem. So first of all, if we are successful in achieving our immediate goal, which is denuclearization of North Korea, then our six-party forums will have to move forward to ensure a certain security framework in Northeast Asia. As you all know, we have something similar in Europe in the name of European Union, which ensures the stability and peace in Europe after the Second World War. In North Korean, Northeast Asian context, we do not have such formula. So it would be quite opportune and appropriate and timely if we could develop this six-party formula to come up with a certain security and political framework in the context of Northeast Asia. That will be quite useful to utilize this ongoing process, because there has never been such a forum in the past. So it is quite useful for us to utilize this existing forum. After year 2012, Korea's relationship with the United States in terms of its military partnership, is it going to be weakened or strengthened or what? We believe that our two countries' military partnership will remain firm and strong. This transfer of operational control during the war times, it's not weakening of our two countries' alliance partnership. Rather, as Ambassador Bourgeois has aptly put it, it's an evolution of our alliance partnership. It's a maturation of our alliance partnership. When you have dependent relationship or uneven relationship, that must have been the thing of the past. Now, in the context of a new relationship between Korea and the United States, in the context of change the U.S. presence in Korea, and in the context of relocation of U.S. troops in Korea, this operational control transfer is rather a relevant development. That is why the United States and South Korea, our two governments, have been in full agreement in the transfer of this operational control during the war time. So we didn't have any difference at all except the appropriate timing. Now, we have gone through with these painful discussions, and we agree even on this timing, and that is year 2012. So by transferring this operational control to South Korea, by which we will have to come up with a new command structure that is much more cooperative and independent structure of cooperating between the commanding office, that will have to be done. But this will mean that our two countries' alliance partnership is going to be much more and much more important and significant. And therefore, I would conclude U.S. commitment to South Korea will remain firm and strong. And with this U.S. commitment, our two countries' alliance relationship will further evolve into some kind of important peaceful force in Northeast Asia, by which I mean U.S. troops which are in South Korea will not defending South Korea alone, because if we come up with a certain peaceful relationship with North Korea, then U.S. forces' role in Korea would be much more important and expanded. That will include some kind of new role, giving new ethos and new justification. That is why we still maintain this important relationship. And as time goes by, this relationship is going to be much more important than before.
Okay. Well, so the first question, our motivation was not, as you described it, relating to China or any other economic power in the Asian region. It was based on our assessment that U.S. and Korean economies were very compatible, and that an FTA between our two countries would definitely serve our mutual economic interests. We've looked at a number of countries as potential FTA partners, and Korea was definitely at the top of the list. And because of the size of the Korean economy, I think the most important country with which we've conducted an FTA negotiation in more than a decade. There may be broader regional implications, but I think there we're focusing more on the economic effects of the FTA and encouraging other countries, other economies in the region, including China, including Japan, to follow Korea's course and open their markets, promote the same kinds of reforms and liberalization that will be mutually beneficial to all countries in the region. It is not a geostrategic game. It's largely driven by economic factors. On the second point, turning to North Korea, I think what you were proposing and what we're trying to do are not mutually exclusive. And I think through the six-party talks, we hope to deal with the immediate challenge of the nuclear weapons, which is a threat to stability in the region. But it is a broader effort which encompasses trying to help the North Koreans to reform and rebuild their dysfunctional economy, to help improve living conditions for the North Korean people, which are abysmal, and tools such as exchanges, technical assistance, all are among the things that we could do if the process begins to gain some momentum. But I think it's difficult to contemplate a fully normal relationship with North Korea until they give up the nukes. And so that's why the agreements that we've reached so far in the six-party talks are very much conditional. If they deliver on denuclearization, the other parties will reciprocate with measures to help them economically. But certainly the country needs reform. It needs the kind of opening up of the society, the free flow of information, the encouragement of entrepreneurship that has helped China. It's helped all the former communist countries of Eastern Europe and Central Europe to improve the lives of their people, and that's the path we'd like to see North Korea follow. South Korea tries to do this through its engagement strategy, there have been some limited results, but I think North Korea has to make some decisions about real economic reforms for engagement to make a more substantial difference. Finally, on the last question, I don't think there's as sharp a contrast between our approaches to Iran and North Korea as you suggest. We are certainly trying to achieve a solution through diplomacy with Iran. The mechanisms are also multilateral. We're working both through the United Nations Security Council and working with key members of the European Union plus Russia in trying to offer Iran a normal relationship with us and with the rest of the world if they accept commitments that would reassure the rest of the world that they are not pursuing nuclear weapons. They have covertly pursued uranium enrichment and other technologies that put them close to the threshold of the capability to develop nuclear weapons. And so far, diplomacy has not yielded many results, but that's still the path that we're on. I think in Iraq, you know, we admit that the intelligence on which our concerns about WMD were based was faulty. But Saddam Hussein, nevertheless, was defying the international community, failing to comply with dozens of UN Security Council resolutions. So there was a basis for military action. But anyway, plowing over the past is not going to solve the immediate problems. And we need to try to leave Iraq in better shape than we found it. And that's the challenge that we all are facing today.
Let me just add a couple of points. First of all, Korea's economic policy or trade policy is not confining to the United States alone. As far as this FTA is concerned, after our trade relationship with or FTA with the United States, we will have to go to the European Union for another trade linkage. We have already done with ASEAN countries and EFTA countries. So we will be going to the European Union for new free trade agreement. But also, we have been talking with Japan on this as well. And also, we are going to launch our discussions with China on this FTA. So FTA, what has been the kind of political motivation in coming up with U.S.-Korea FTA relationship? I don't think there was a certain conspiracy agenda in coming up with this. As far as we are concerned, we are going to conclude as many FTA agreement as possible with major economies in the world. Concerning this exchange with North Korea, not simply focusing on the nuclear issue, you are right. That is why South Korea has come up with this engagement policy since the year 2000. Of course, this was based on our own belief that unless we do something about North Korea, in terms of its own economy, in terms of exchange between the peoples and the two countries, I mean, we simply cannot resolve this North Korean, South Korean confrontation. In the past, we have lived under that confrontational relationship. Perhaps it was too long. And we wanted to come up with a cooperational scheme, less confrontation, with more cooperation as much as possible. That's why we came up with this engagement policy. It went to a certain extent, and when we found a new information that North Korea was working on this nuclear program, then this political process has been stalled. Although we like to continue this political process, but we simply cannot go beyond as if nothing had happened when we have this nuclear ambition of North Korea. That is why we are focusing our attention on this nuclear issue. And at the same time, we will have to put in place a certain process of political reconciliation and exchange of peoples and others as well. That's also very important. If you remember what happened between the United States and China back in 1997-72, ping pong started the political process, and that's very important. I take note of that.